The Venturi's Voice podcast brings together some of technology's brightest minds to discuss all things leadership, technology, and staffing. Keep the conversation going in the Venturi's Voice Slack group and have the opportunity to meet some of our amazing guests. You can download Venturi's Voice via iTunes or via the Venturi Group website at venturi-group.com. Today's guest is Matthew Sinclair, Engineering Director of London at BCG Digital Ventures. It's kind of a unique model, if you want to call it that, as what you're involved in. And something I find particularly fascinating from being from kind of the startup background. And I just can't think personally of something that might be more compelling or more interesting to be a part of is, you know, kind of building startups, but building startups with money. It's like a win-win situation. I'm sure it must feel like that all the time, Matthew.
Yeah, it's you still have to be as diligent with the money as you otherwise would be. It's just really coming from a different source. So, you know, instead of being from a VC, it's from corporate partners. But I still think we have to pretend it. I try every day to pretend it's like my money. You know, would I do this with my money?
Right. I mean, I think that's a good philosophy for anyone, really, isn't it? Is any part of a team is just to think, if this was my money, would I spend it? Maybe not think that much because I am pretty tight, so nothing would ever actually get spent. So maybe not to that extreme for me. But it's probably a good kind of philosophy to stand by. But I think for me, as much as anything, what's compelling about what you're working on is the kind of collaboration with, you know, some really interesting and intelligent people. You know, I think there's a wide mix as well, because I'm sure there's a variety of projects that you end up working on. But, you know, that side of things must be, you know, just a fantastic environment. You know, the amount of intelligent people, creative ideas and collaboration that must go on. How inspiring can that be, you know, on a kind of daily basis, being surrounded by that? Or I suppose, is it something that, you know, you can potentially take for granted?
No, I definitely don't take it for granted. I've been building software for 25 years or so now in various forms, working for big corporates and banks back in Australia and working in startups. This is the most intense, creatively intense place I've worked, by a significant margin. The quality of the people here, I think it's a London thing as much as anything as well. Just the intensity of the stuff that goes on in here. I call it the city. I know it's not the city, capital C city, but sort of in London itself as a city. Coming from Australia has been eye opening for me over the last 3 years. But also just the nature of the work we do. I think it attracts a certain kind of person. And then the structure of how we put things together, it creates a certain dynamic. We constantly have this idea of this multidisciplinary team. You know, every day I sit around the table with designers and venture architects and client embeds that we might have and whatnot. And it's a great dynamic.
So, you know, a lot of people have different experiences throughout the career that I think whenever you move and you progress throughout your career, you tend to learn something in some sort of way. Well, at least I hope people do. And for you, did you feel that there was anything that was going to kind of prepare you for this kind of next step? You know, you said that you worked in, you know, a variety of different industries, experiences, size of company, etc. Even living, you know, in a different country is probably impactful as well. What do you think that there was, or is there anything that prepared you for, you know, working on the projects that you're working on now?
I was reflecting on this exact point the other day in a conversation with someone here, and what surprised me in the move from Australia to the UK wasn't what I was expecting to be surprised by. And what I mean by that was that what we were doing, or I was doing in the various roles that I had back in Australia from an engineering point of view. So if you just look at the quality of the engineering, it's not that different to what I'm doing here today. So the engineering level conversations that I may have been having with people back in Australia, were similar, to the kind of engineering conversations that I'm having here with people, the big difference is management and the sort of collaboration process that we go through and also the selling process. Australians, in my experience, Australians are actually pretty good engineers and, you know, we're kind of distributed around the world doing that. What we're terrible at, though, is management. And that's a big difference. You know, the level, the quality of management that I see here in London is vastly superior to what I ever had to experience in Australia. Which I found, I wasn't expecting that at all.
Right. That is really interesting. So can you elaborate on that bit as far as what that goes, you know, as far as, is it a structure thing? Is it a philosophy thing? Like what kind of traits did you identify that were kind of significantly better with regards to the management?
We're probably going to get into some philosophy and sort of cultural DNA things, I think. There's no doubt that Australia has a sort of colonial heritage to it, and it's pretty deep seated. We're very, I know there's this sort of archetype of the larrikin Australian and the rule breaker, but actually it's a nation of people who follow the rules, and you see it in business and you see it everywhere. You know, like just people follow the road rules and there's, you know, local councils have all these rules and people just take it for granted. And I never really appreciated it till I moved away. When English people came to Australia, they were often complaining about all these rules and I never really appreciated it. And what I've noticed over here, and it's all strata, like it's just sort of in, you know, the local community, but also business, a lot of rules are advisory. If you are persistent enough or have the right motivation, you can kind of, you know, you can make the rules just up to suit yourself, which I find fascinating. It's fantastic in it when you're doing entrepreneurial work like we do here, because often you would try and do something in Australia, and I saw this in startups a lot. You try and do something where it was breaking the rules a bit and it was just so hard to get to make any movement with it or get any traction. But over here, there's a sense that, well, no, the rules are there, sure, but we can do these things. If we're going to do something better, you know, we can still have a crack at it. So I'm really enjoying that process. Actually, I fear when I go back to Australia, I might get myself into trouble.
People, is it getting people to that kind of jump on board with ideas as well is the difficulty?
That is exactly the issue, right? So one thing that I noticed after doing a bit of work in the States was that the reason I think that the States has been so successful with startups and it's such a thing in the US business community is it actually takes, there's two things that have to happen. You have to come up with the idea, right? So a startup has to have an idea, but you have to have someone prepared to buy it. All right. And the businesses in the US and also here in Europe, I've noticed they seem to be much more willing to buy ideas from startups than they were back in Australia. I spent many years failing to sell stuff to banks. And you know, you go through this conversation where, okay, interesting idea, interesting technology, where is it being used? And it's like, well, it isn't being used anywhere because it's a new idea. And then you just sort of get lost in this frustration. And I, you know, part of that's my own inability to sell. Excuse me, no doubt about that. But when I did some work in the States, what I found amazing was, businesses would say, well, we know that in order to be differentiating, we have to go outside what would normally be a commodity or buy stuff that's off the shelf. And they're prepared to make investments in startup ideas as a purchaser of the products that they're selling. And that was quite instructive. I mean, I've seen that here too. You know, we are doing stuff that I know in Australia would be very difficult to get up because you just come up against this more. I haven't seen that done before. Where's that being, you know, where's that running in production? And it'd be really tricky to get it up.
Interesting. It is interesting. I suppose I wouldn't have had that perception, but I suppose I've not really known anyone in Australia who's gone out and built a startup. My only experience or what I've heard about the Australian rules is that you will get ID'd regardless of how old you look in all of the bars. And I found that quite
That is so true. That is absolutely true. It was kind of a mark of pride of mine, you know, in my late 30s and early 40s, getting carded at bars.
yeah, that's my only experience. So if that philosophy spills over into startups, then I can understand the frustration. Totally get it now. Yeah, you got to dumb things down for me, Matthew, for it to make sense.
Right. And I mean, it just applies everywhere. So it's also structural, the nature of the Australian economy. I mean, I'm not sure how interesting this is to your listeners, but the nature of the Australian economy is interesting. There's a very small number of large companies at the top and a very large number of small companies at the bottom. Small business is the single largest employer by a significant margin. And there's just not much in the middle. Whereas if you look at, you know, say the German economy, for example, it's made up of those middle market businesses in the middle, and the same in the US, just vast numbers of mid-sized businesses. You know, obviously they have the big businesses as well, but it's just a funny structural setup of the Australian economy.
It is interesting. It is really interesting. You know, getting into, I suppose, the kind of work that you've managed to get into, you didn't necessarily start off, I suppose, in quote-unquote the business side. You know, you started off as an engineer. I can imagine that, you know, that the kind of technical workload that, you know, you used to have has probably nowhere near to the extent that it once was. And now it's probably much more around, I suppose, you know, the business side of things. You know, that's not the easiest transition to build up that skill set. Was that, I'd assume it took time, but was there kind of a point in your career where there was that conscious move into more of kind of a business, maybe leadership type role? And, you know, is that kind of an experience that you feel a lot of engineers have to face at some point in their career, you know, that kind of point of infliction?
Yeah. Okay. So there's a lot there. Yes, it was a so I'll start from the beginning. I don't do anywhere near as much programming as I used to. That's certainly true. But in order to stay fresh with it, I do still tinker around, and I call it recreational coding, which I know is a kind of massively geeky thing to say, but I'll sit down and write some code for the fun of it just so I've got a sense of what's going on. I find it's a bit disingenuous to be managing engineers who are professionals and highly skilled if you don't have some – I refer to this concept of sympathy for software. If you don't have some sympathy for what is hard and what is easy about software, I think it's difficult to authentically manage clever people who are doing that as their, you know, their kind of deep skill set. So I try and keep my hand in a little bit. I haven't, the last time I had wrote any code that was in production was on Coop, but it was a tiny amount. I think it was probably just in the you know, some of the testing stuff. But what I do get involved in is the kind of the intellectual conversations that go around the design. I'm actively involved in that stuff as much as I can be. So you know, yes, as you move on in your career, it's harder to be directly involved in writing code, but I still enjoy it. Your second question about was there a conscious moment? And absolutely. I was sick and tired back when I did my MBA. I was sick and tired of being managed by people that I thought were, you know, not really up to the job. And so the reason I did an MBA was to go and get the language, the vocabulary of business, so that I could communicate with the people, you know, who were supposed to be managing me in their language. And so that was definitely a conscious decision to do that. And I got a lot more out of the MBA than I expected to be honest. I was a bit cynical about the whole process, if I'm honest, going into it. But I actually met a lot of really, really smart people. And one of the kind of thinking models that I got out of it was this sort of idea of building frameworks and applying frameworks to your thinking, and that's stuck with me. It's great, and the org psychology stuff is fascinating. Sort of just understanding ultimately everything we do is about people, and having some insight into the way people think, you know, individual differences, this kind of stuff. Just having that in your arsenal, conceptual arsenal, when you're talking to people is super powerful. I also thought naively, possibly, that I would bring an engineering lens to that. And so that was, you know, that was the quid pro quo. I'll learn your language, but then I'm going to be able to communicate with you, you know, how engineers think and what's going on with engineering. And I've tried to do that, you know, ever since then.
The MBA is an interesting one because I've you know, a lot of people kind of go back and forth about the idea. And I, you know, what I typically find with people is who actually do the MBA, they always seem surprised about how much substance they get out of that experience. I don't know why that is, why people are surprised by it. But they always seem to be. And so it's not the first time I've heard someone kind of be like, and actually, you know, I got, you know, some great learnings from that. But there's clearly some value in that. And I think the greater scale of things is also just, as you alluded to, meeting some really interesting people and some really intelligent people in the business world who you can therefore kind of go forward and spar ideas from.
I think there's been a bit of a shift as well in what an MBA is. So, in the say the you know the 80s and 90s, an MBA was your classic sort of MBA, business school MBA. But I think just when I started, this idea of entrepreneurialism and strategic entrepreneurialism was started to come through, and startups. And so at least half the people in my MBA, I started in 2000. Half the people in that course were doing the MBA so that they could go and do their own startups. And of my cohort, the folks that I went through with, probably, you know, a third of them have gone on to start businesses in one form or another. Some successful, some less successful, but, you know, they were doing the MBA to, in the same way that I mentioned, to kind of get the language of business, such that they could apply their, whatever their functional technical skills were in some startup environment. So I think that's being carried out now. You know, a lot of MBAs, chats and helping out with one of the schools here in London, with one of their startup clubs, and the whole club that there is dedicated to starting businesses, being involved in startups somehow. Very few of them, if any, are going to go and take that traditional route into of that group, at least, into, you know, management consulting or enterprise, traditional enterprise management.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a positive thing, though. You know, I think
I agree.
Yeah. I think there's, we've probably got enough management consultants in the world. I think we'll be all right. But I think the way of thinking for me, you know, my experience, I lived in the States for a number of years, and I always said that, you know, this is probably people have heard this a million times, but the attitude that they had, you know, especially in California where I was based for a number of years, was very much that they kind of encouraged entrepreneurship, and they actually like celebrated, you know, failure. And what I mean by that is, you know, people who gave it a go and are giving it a go and it's not worked out. And they kind of had that support, and it was like, yeah, that's amazing. You gave it a shot. Great. You know, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, kind of empty headedness, just going at things that are, you know, unrealistic. We're talking about, you know, people doing calculated moves into trying to build startups. And obviously you have the backing out there, but for me, it was the attitude, that even, you know, you talk about the difference between Australia and coming to London. It was noticeable for me coming from the States to the UK, and the difference in the attitude there. It still was kind of almost frowned upon if you kind of failed, you know, or you gave something a go instead of, you know, going down the traditional road. And I think that we're at a really compelling time, especially in the UK over the last few years, where I can see that attitude bit by bit is switching, and I think that's really, really exciting. And you can just sense it. You know, you go down, you know, Old Street and all that kind of area, and it's just full of it. And that's, I think, something that it is relatively new to the UK, and something that, you know, the Americans have had for a long time. And I think that's why they've had the success. And I think, you know, doing these kind of, everyone needs support, but I think people just knowing and having the attitude that, you know what, if I don't give something a go, I'm going to regret it. And if I do give it a go, you know, what's the worst thing that can possibly happen? And, you know, not having kind of the, you know, being looked down upon if you do fail. And you know, that seems like something that wouldn't be a consideration in someone's mind. But it is subconsciously. It absolutely is. And I think, you know, the environment can, you know, heighten that sensitivity towards things like that.
So you're absolutely right. The fear of failure is completely paralyzing in modern enterprises, and this is one of the biggest problems with trying to innovate in large businesses. It's much easier to just let something sort of wither away slowly, you know, like T.S. Eliot said, to this is the way the world ends, not with a bang but a whimper. It's much easier to do that than kill something, because killing it, kind of implies that there's been a failure. We're really sort of transparent about the risk of failure in what we do, and you have to be, because when you're taking risks, some of them aren't going to succeed, right? And you know, you have to be authentic enough and honest enough about it, transparent enough about it, to be able to call it for what it is. I can't remember who said it, but if you're not taking risks that have a chance of failure, a significant chance of failure, the risk isn't really a risk, right? And hence the return's probably not there either. We are very, in everything we do here, we're very clear about the fact that, you know, there's a percentage of the stuff that we do isn't going to succeed. And that's why, I mean, this is just sort of what we do, is apply portfolio theory to startups. And simply, you know, we develop a portfolio of ideas and we run multiple things, multiple ideas concurrently, because we know some aren't going to work. And the other thing that's really important in the world we're in, which is corporate venture capital, is that innovation in enterprise is really tricky, because corporations muster antibodies to prevent it. And people don't really want to talk about this, but basically the reason a big enterprise is a big enterprise is because there's a whole bunch of people whose job it is to make sure nothing changes, because the cash flow and the customers and the brand can't be interrupted if the business is to continue doing what it's doing. And so the kind of these organized big organizations muster antibodies that sort of stamp out or quash innovation when it starts to happen. And that's something we have to battle against. And our general approach to that problem is to pull the innovation out of the environment and do it somewhere else. So we're pretty big believers in having doing those innovative activities in a different environment, so that they're not they don't get attacked by the antibodies, the innovation antibodies that are mustered by the corporation.
I love that, antibodies. It's such a great, great turn of phrase, and probably very, very accurate. I it confuses the hell out of me, because sure, we talk about companies that are making phenomenal profits, you know, profits, that's after everything's paid for, phenomenal profits, right? And surely there's got to be a sense of responsibility that they feel towards innovation. It's never made sense to me whatsoever, other than, you know, it's human nature to kind of, I suppose, be, you know, self-pervasive. And I think that's what it really boils down to. You know, if it was robots running it, that investment would go back into things, and we would have, you know, that kind of consistency put into innovation. But, you know, there's a lot of people that are on, you know, bloated salaries, I suppose. I don't like to immediately go there, but it's got to be the main reason why they don't feel that great sense of responsibility to innovate and invest in the future.
So I think it's rational behaviour. Now, we can argue the ethics or the morals of some parts of it, but let's not go there. But it's actually rational behaviour for organisations to behave the way they're behaving. The reason they're successful and the reason they have the cash flow, you know, and the profits is because they've built this machine which generates those, you know, which satisfies some sort of customer friction and generates the you know, profitably addresses it, right? So it's rational to try and maintain that as it is. And what's irrational in my mind is to try and put innovation or try and do innovation in that environment when you know in advance that the machine that you've built is going to actively try and suppress it, right? Because, you know, if it's been successful, that's what it's good at, making sure nothing changes. And so the sort of enlightened approach to that is, okay, if you think you're going to be disrupted or you think you need to do some innovation, you've got to do it in a way that avoids that antibody response from your organization.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that's what the model is that you guys are involved in now, though, right? I guess that's the...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and it's not just us. There's you know, there's a lot of thinking around how you do innovation and where you do it, and there's also a lot of roadkill around the wrong ways to do it, which you can see from, you know, your classic sort of innovation lab where a bunch of people without, you know, time or cost pressures get to tinker around and don't ever end up producing anything, you know. So I would argue that's just as ineffective as you know, not innovating.
Agreed. I want to kind of change the topic a little bit about something you were mentioning when we spoke last time, and it was around how you're kind of trying to write more now.
Oh, yes.
You don't have, you know, you have a blog that you're kind of proactively doing. I think it's a great habit, and it requires a tremendous amount of discipline, because I think most people have been through spurts of it, and I kind of turned to the podcast because it was easier, to be honest. But I think that, you know, the ability to write and completely zone everything out, it's almost like a form of meditation in a lot of ways. And I'd just like you to kind of elaborate a little bit more on why, you know, you're kind of working towards this and trying to incorporate it into, you know, some of your behaviors.
Okay. Yeah. So it goes back to a desire of mine that's been there for many, many, many years to write a book. And I've always thought that I've got a at least one good story in me. But then I also recognize that being an author is an incredibly challenging activity that requires enormous discipline and not just that, it's a craft. I think people forget this in artistic endeavors. There's the art part or the creativity part, which is sort of the bit that you see at the end, but they forget there's this underlying craft that you have to develop. You know, painting, for example, is obviously this creativity and art, artisanship in it, but you also have to understand how colors work and how to put colors onto canvas and, you know, how to do treatments of pictures before you paint. You know, there's all this craft that you learn, you know, through years and years of doing it. And writing is no different to that. I mean, programming, to be fair, is no different to that. And so what I said about doing for myself, I've got a kind of probably a four step process. I first of all wanted to instill discipline. And so my first attack on this was just simply to write about 250 words a week. That was like a link blog post, just to sort of editorialize over some links that I'd found interesting and try and create a thread of relevance between the links. And I did that for a year. I did 52 posts or whatever it was in 2016, 2017. And then step two is, to kick it up a gear by trying to write something original every week. And that's been challenging. I may have exhausted my wellspring of thoughts on managing engineers, which is where I've drawn most of the topics from. And then the third phase of it is, once I've got the discipline and once I've got my kind of creative head in a spot where it allows me to do something, I've got some ideas for some fiction and nonfiction books that I want to try and write. But that's probably another year away yet.
Is it something you've kind of done and kind of encouraged other people to try and do it, or is it something that you've just very much done kind of for yourself? Was the rationale behind it in the first place, I suppose? Or?
So the inspiration comes from the fact that I've personally been inspired by books over my life. Like, I'm an avid reader, and I've read I don't know how many books in my life, but I've read a lot. These days I actually end up listening to audiobooks more than reading them physically because of my commute, but, you know, it's more or less the same thing. And so I've felt enormously privileged to have read the stuff that I've read over the years. There's a second, more practical thing, which is there's a kind of thinking that appears, to me at least, to only happen when stuff gets out of my head. It's one thing to reflect on stuff internally, but it's another thing entirely to try and put your thoughts down on paper in a way that someone else can consume them, and it whittles the ideas down, hopefully down to the essential part. It makes the ideas a lot better. I call this with my team, I call it thinking in the open, You know, I think ideas are much better once they've gone through a few people's heads, often anyway. And so that's the part of that process is for me going, oh, you know, I've got this thought, but it's actually pretty ill-defined. And it's only when you try and write it down and explain it in plain English that you take it from just this random set of thoughts into something more coherent. I have no desire to be like this blog. I don't care if anyone, I genuinely don't care if anyone listens, reads it or not. It's purely for my edification. I'm using it as a discipline. And to be honest, your comment about it being like a meditation is bang on. It is very similar, to getting flow. Like it's a way for me to get flow, to sit down and try and spend, you know, an hour or so, a couple of hours every week writing something coherent.
I like it. Yeah. Have you read that book, Flow, by the way? Have you ever read that?
I don't think I have. I think I know the book you're talking about. I had the idea of flow explained to me as a young programmer, and it's such a true concept. I call it the flywheel in my case, like the time I have to sit down and my productivity as a programmer on day three after I've had flow is probably two orders of magnitude higher than what it was on day one when I'm just getting the flywheel going.
Yeah. It's true. I need to read it. I've actually got the book. It's just pure laziness on my part. Again, I'm clearly not very disciplined at this time. So maybe I'll read it, be inspired, and then hopefully just do something. I think whatever it is, you know, writing, blogging, whatever your thing is, I think it's so important to have something, isn't it? You know, that kind of something where you stay focused. Even just using some brain training games, maybe. No, I'm not. Not plugging Lumosity or anything, but something like that helps. I think is really important for you, for everyone. I think is regardless of what it is, might not be writing your thing, but something outside of the day to day, because work's just made up of so many distractions, isn't it? That it's very difficult to get into that state. So anything you can do to enhance that is productive, I think.
Being creative, whatever the medium, is enormously rewarding. And I know it's sets off as a cliche, but when you do it, you realize that it is. I've been following just this week. I found this woman called Laurie Santos from Yale, and I'm going to post a link to some of her stuff in this week's blog. But she teaches a course on happiness. She's a happiness researcher. And it's funny how bad we are at recognizing the things that make us happy. And she's got a, if you look it up, Laurie, Laurie Santos, just do a Google search for her. She's got some amazing stuff. She's got a couple of TED videos. And in fact, she's about to publish, or has published, I should say, the entire course on Coursera for free. So you can actually sit down and do a course on happiness. And, creativity and giving some time to be creative is a fundamental part of that.
Awesome, mate. Yeah, I'll have to check that out. What was it? Laurie Santos, did you say?
Laurie Santos from Yale. Yeah. Yeah. If you Google that, you'll find her. She's pretty, I mean, I've only just found her, but apparently she's huge.
Right. Well, yeah, I'll have to check that out. I don't want to keep you for too much longer. I know, even though Matthew, I've not covered anywhere near all the points that I'd probably have liked to. So maybe that's a sign that it's for another time potentially.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, I kind of close it there. I think that we'll just kind of leave it there, I think, without me kind of rambling on. So is there any way, if anyone wants to get in contact, read your blog? I know that's not like the goal of anything, but if anyone's interested to read any of your stuff, what's the blog called?
Well, if anyone is predisposed to listening to a middle-aged white guy bloviate about how to manage smart engineers and a few other topics, then you can find me on Medium at Matthew Sinclair, all lowercase, all one word.
Awesome. Matthew, cheers, mate. I genuinely really enjoyed it. It was difficult for me to stop it, actually, because I wish we could have gone on. But hopefully we'll do it again soon. And again, thank you so much for taking the time. Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.